You see what Thanos just did? Better pray for the Marvel Universe.
You are Locked On Fantasy Basketball, your daily podcast on fantasy basketball. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team, every day.
Hello and welcome to the Locked On Fantasy Basketball podcast brought to you by Basketball Monster. My name is Josh Lloyd and I am the lead fantasy analyst at basketballmonster.com, and you can find me on Twitter as always at redrock_bball. Let's go with another of the season recap podcasts today. We are going to be looking at the Brooklyn Nets, and to talk about the Brooklyn Nets, I am joined by my Basketball Monster colleague, Kyle McEwen. Kyle, welcome to the show.
Hello, Josh.
Let's talk some Brooklyn Nets. I don't know, because these podcasts are being recorded in advance and out of order, so I don't know how many shows you've already been on. I know you've been on a few already this season, but this is a really interesting team to talk about who didn't have any real stars during the year, but had a lot of fantasy contributors all across the course of the season. They finished the year 28-54, 12th in the Eastern Conference, so nowhere near the worst team in the NBA, which they had been in previous years. They had the 21st best offense, the 22nd best defense. They were 6th in the NBA in pace, not something that is surprising under Kenny Atkinson. 2nd in three-point attempt rate, again, not a surprise under Kenny Atkinson. Struggled with forcing turnovers, struggled with taking care of the ball. All things that we sort of anticipated with this team is they're still feeling their way out, still trying to, you know, tread water and develop their young guys until they can get themselves some draft picks and really start to make a difference on this squad. In terms of draft picks this year, they only have picked 29, 40, and 45, which is better than they would have had heading into the season. They acquired that first rounder from the Raptors in the Damari Carroll deal. But heading into the 2018-19 season, they have all their first-round draft picks back. So they've got some hope there. Not necessarily that they're going to be moving into the playoffs, but at least they might be able to get themselves a top 10 pick or a top 5 pick that they choose themselves, that they can develop on this team. In terms of their free agency situation, they've got a few unrestricted guys: Jahlil Okafor, who was shithouse, Dante Cunningham, Quincy Acey, and Jumpin' Joe Harris. I think Harris is probably the most important player out of that group. Restricted free agents, there's Sauce Castillo, Nick Stauskas, and then their two-way guys, Milton Doyle and Jim Webb the third. While Spencer Dinwiddie and Isaiah Whitehead both have non-guaranteed deals, there is zero chance that Dinwiddie's deal is not being guaranteed. Whitehead's, I wouldn't be so sure. So we've basically got a very, very similar core of this team, with the only real guy that we need to check on in free agency is Harris, who was on a minimum deal and has earned himself a lot more money than that heading into next season. But, you know, his spot in the rotation could just very easily be taken by Jeremy Lin, who played just one game for the season for the Nets. I talked about this team having no stars, Kyle. They had nobody inside the top 90 in fantasy ranks on a per game basis, but they had 7 players inside the top 130, just showing that all these guys are in this same range. And let's start with the guy that did end up the year with the highest fantasy rank, and that's Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, the 94th ranked player. Overall, he played 28 minutes per game, 13.9 points, almost 7 boards, 2.5 assists, a steal and 0.7 blocks for 47-79 as his shooting percentage is a pretty pitiful 24% from 3, and he has yet to crack 30% from 3 throughout his NBA career. But it was definitely a big leap forward for Hollis-Jefferson, a larger role, increased usage, an extra 6 minutes per game, and I thought he was relatively impressive this season.
No, Rondae is a great player. It's just he's an awkward fit in a lot of regard, because he's used almost exclusively at power forward by the Brooklyn Nets. We are recording the Nets and the Jazz together. So there's a lot to like about Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, but he's an awkward player to fit into your scheme, because he doesn't shoot a lot of three pointers. He doesn't hit three-pointers at a great clip. So you're taking a wing defender guy who can do a little bit in regards to putting the ball on the floor and going to the rack, but so much of his offense is unconventional that It's been fun to see how the Nets have integrated him, and the fact that Hiles Jefferson is a positive contributor for this team, and arguably their best player when you take both sides of the court into account. But it's difficult to say how far they can go when he's still kind of considered that guy who is their best player. They need a lot more talent on this roster, and it'll be interesting to see how his game develops going forward, since he is kind of a unique uniquely skilled player in today's NBA, where you generally focus on players developing their shooting and their and using a guy who has big size at a smaller, lower position, rather than pushing him up, or sometimes even occasionally using Rondae Hollis-Jefferson as the backup center.
Yeah, he played at center a bit this season as well. He was a guy that took his scoring per 36 up by almost 4 points, up from 13.8 to 17.7. That's clearly a big jump. But I think the worrying thing for in terms of us looking at his fantasy value, and why we were so intrigued with him as a rookie, is he had a massive steal rate, 2.3 steals in his rookie year, 1.7 last year, 1.2 this year. That is a huge, huge drop off for a guy that was putting up. Look, and his per game steal numbers look the same, 1.3, 1.11. You go, it's not too much different, but it's when you look at how that equates to minutes played that's the real concern. You think you're going from 21 to 28 minutes, you'd be able to take your steals from 1.3 to 1.8 and go, now I'm set. Now I've got a top 70, a top 60 sort of a guy, and pair that with the increased scoring, the increased efficiency as he took his true shooting up to 55%, the strong rebounding, the improvement in his passing this year. All these things improved, but that steal rate dipped, and that just really sapped a lot of those improvements from what Hollis Jefferson. Now, he's improved a lot, but he didn't improve to the level that we hoped he would have when we saw him be, you know, really impressive defensively in his rookie season. And those, he's still been impressive defensively, but his overall defensive metrics that we care about for fantasy haven't come through in that regard. The blocks have been fine. They're still solid. It's just that steal rate, which can swing your value by 20, 30, 40 spots really easily, hasn't come through. And if he had averaged 1.8 steals this year, we're talking about a top 60 player probably, even with the other numbers that he's got there. But I do have my concerns that maybe that rookie year was the anomaly, and the increased focus on his offensive stuff and improving his shooting and being a more higher usage player is taking the focus off him being that player who does provide those steals and those turnovers for this team. So that's something I'm a little bit concerned with as we move forward with him.
Agreed.
Cool. Let's talk about the next guy on this list. One of the biggest surprises of the season, Spencer Dinwiddie, played 80 games, 29 minutes, 12.6 points, 1.8 threes, 3 rebounds, 6.5 assists, and 0.9 steals. A horrible shooter. 39% from the field, 33% from three, 81% from the line. Now, Kyle, way back when I started this podcast, we did a Detroit Pistons season preview, and we talked about Spencer, didn't we? And we said how much we liked him. We said he had the sexiest mustache in the NBA, which was clearly true at the time. And we talked about him a lot coming out of Colorado with the ACL injury in the second round. Thought this is a great pick by the Pistons. And then they cut him. And then they traded him, sorry. And then the Bulls, because they have no idea what they're doing in terms of any sort of talent evaluation, they cut him. And I wish I could remember the player that they signed so they could cut him. I think it was RJ Hunter, which is just laughable. But they cut him so that they could sign some other piece of crap NBA player. And Dinwiddie really flourished this season. But we can talk about how good he was, and you can make all the arguments, oh, he's better than D'Angelo Russell, whatever you want to do. But it doesn't matter if I think he's better than D'Angelo Russell. It doesn't matter if you think he's better than D'Angelo Russell. It doesn't matter if Joe Big Dick on Twitter thinks that he's better than D'Angelo Russell. If Kenny Atkinson doesn't think he's better than D'Angelo Russell, then his value is going to be capped. And that's the concern, is when Russell came back at the end of the year, we saw Dinwiddie move to a smaller role, to a bench role, and whether that was evaluation, whether that's an indication for the future, that is the concern. And the fact that he's on this contract, that the Nets could be able to get some significant assets back for him in a trade, I do feel a little bit worried about Dinwiddie, for as much as I like him, in terms of where this is all heading.
Yeah, I mean, if the Nets come into next season and they're healthy and Jeremy Lin is able to be a part of the rotation, it's really hard to see how Spencer Dinwiddie fits in beyond being used in a bench role. Obviously, he could still potentially play 20 to 25 minutes off the bench for this Nets team just because that's how Kenny Atkinson does things. He doesn't necessarily care who played the set amount of minutes last game. He's going to come in, and depending on what matchups he wants to run out there or who he thinks has the hot hand and deserves to be out on the court, he'll go with them on a given night. And he, as we saw through Joe Harris, he's not afraid to lean on some guys who many people may think should be outside the rotation or should, you know, not be a big part of it. Kenny Atkinson doesn't care.
Yeah, no, not at all. And he did. He was benched for the majority of the end of the season, or most from the 16th of March onwards up until the last game of the season that he played against the Bulls, where he did start and played 35 minutes there, but he was on the bench and he played 33 minutes in some games, 12 in another, 35, 19. He was all over the place, but his production was nowhere near the level that it was when D'Angelo Russell was out, where he was consistently taking big shots, making big shots, taking, you know, crunch time shots, winning games for the Nets, you know, scoring big runs. He'll get a run in January of 26, 20, and 31 points with 9, 3, and 8 assists, getting steals in that time. But I do get the feeling, and again, we both really liked Dinwiddie as a player. He was a big positive for this team. You can compare his and D'Angelo Russell's on-off numbers, and Dinwiddie was a plus 3.9 and Russell was a negative 4.6, and you can use that as your argument that he's a better player than Russell as much as you want. But in the end, it doesn't matter what we think or what you think or what that tells us. If Atkinson wants to play Russell and Lynn over Dinwiddie, then it doesn't matter because he's not going to be able to get those sort of numbers. And for as impressive as he was, he still was only the 99th ranked player this season in 29 minutes. And you get the feeling that that could be career high numbers. He only averaged 12.5 points and 6.5 assists. These aren't sparkling, spectacular numbers. He couldn't shoot. 39% is not good. Now, all these things can improve, clearly, but I just feel there's a confluence of events around Dinwiddie, and maybe there is 14,605 different outcomes for him. But I can't necessarily see, you know, many of them being the one where he starts and becomes a 33-minute per game guy who averages 15 and 7 with two steals. I just don't see that there. And did you enjoy my little opening quote / Infinity War tie in there?
It was very good. Wow, that was the number that Dr. Strange said.
It was.
That when he looked into the alternate, the number of different realities, or yeah, cool. Yeah,
just doing the crossover. Just you gotta. It's how I work as a podcasting professional. As I sit here, in my shorts on a chair in my kitchen.
I knew you were either referencing Infinity War or the musical Rent, but I wasn't sure which one.
Have not seen that one. So yeah, that was a fair assumption to go in the Infinity War direction, because not a massive Rent guy. And by that,
well, then you miss out on that little.
I'm gonna have to go
little
back
nugget.
Oh yeah,
and there's
going to have to watch that now.
Rent fans. Well, I'm not even a Rent fan necessarily, but I've seen the movie, and there's this big production about 16,025,000, whatever. I don't know it, but I don't know it well enough. But yeah, it was a good reference. Clap on the back, me.
Well done. I will. I'll go back and I'll give you a retrospective appreciation tweet or something once I go back and watch Rent. Now let's move on to another point guard, someone who we have been referencing a bit in this show. Let's talk D'Angelo Russell, who came across in the Timofey Mozgov / Brook Lopez Kyle Kuzma trade. Only played 48 games and only 26 minutes per game, but still averaged 15.5 points, 2 threes, 4 rebounds, 5 assists, and 0.8 steals, 42, 74, and 33%. Again, not really great shooting numbers from him either, but took on a large usage rate of almost 31% and was the 104th ranked player for the season. And to me, he is a much higher upside player than Dinwiddie. He's a much higher fantasy upside player. They finished 5 ranking spots apart and 3 minutes per game difference with Dinwiddie in the lead there. If they played equal minutes, then Russell would have been considerably higher. I thought he had a chance to be a top 50 guy this year, A, because I didn't think he'd miss 40 games and didn't think he'd play only 26 minutes per game for the year. I still have significant hope in him as a fantasy guy. I'm not sure about him real life stuff. He still has defensive issues, but we saw him explode many times, especially when he came back from that knee injury, which I thought was encouraging to see him do that. I thought his defensive stuff was improved at times this year, but there's still a long way to go. But I still believe in him as a top 50 upside fantasy guy.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as much positive stuff, as we said, about Spencer Dinwiddie in just regards to the feeling about who Spencer Dinwiddie is as a player. You were transitioning to D'Angelo Russell, and people might be surprised to hear us saying these more positive things about D'Angelo Russell in regard to his fantasy production next year. D'Angelo Russell is a frustrating player to watch. You get some of this mentality that he has on the court. It kind of mirrors like a Nick Young in regard to his carelessness at times on offense, or his lack of understanding of the moment, lack of feel. But when you look at his production, and you make the excuses that you can make about D'Angelo Russell's career to this point, you see a wealth of opportunity for him to take that next step, the step that we anticipated he was going to take this last year with the Nets. But he could definitely play more minutes next season. He could absolutely have a lot more opportunity. Again, there's a lot of moving pieces on this Nets team in regard to the health of Jeremy Lin, exactly what Spencer Dinwiddie's role turns into next year. But I still think there's a lot to be positive about in regard to D'Angelo Russell, but he's going to have that potential bust tag on him until he proves that he can be a consistent winner in this league and not somebody whose talent is always above his production.
He shot well from mid-range, 43% on his mid-range twos, and he's a guy that can create his own shot. And for a team like this in particular, it is really important to be able to get your own shot off. He was in the 68th percentile in terms of the amount of his made buckets that were assisted. 31% of his shots were assisted. Dinwiddie at 34% is, and it might not seem like much, 3 percentage points, but when we're talking about, you know, the range of these guys, Russell's in the 68th percentile, Dinwiddie's in the 88th percentile. So it is a significant difference there in terms of being able to create your own shot as well. So that's important to know, to be able to see a guy who is able to get his own shot and to be able to create that shot. That is important, in my opinion anyway, being able to do that. Gets his own mid-range shots and as I said, was able to hit them at a pretty solid rate as well. I think there is still significant upside there. But what about Jeremy Lin, Kyle? Or have you got something else to say on Russell?
Russell's still got the potential to take an Oladipo leap. So don't write him off. That's all.
Yeah, exactly. There's still a lot there. And again, he's only heading into his fourth NBA season. The knee injuries, that they do worry me a little bit, just because of obviously we've seen that be an issue across his first three NBA seasons. So that is somewhat of a concern. But I don't know. I still have decent hope in him, but you know, if it doesn't happen by next year, then I'll start to be a little bit more concerned as we look long term at him. Now, Lin only played the one game, 25 minutes before tearing that patella tendon. 18-4 he got in that game, and we thought he was a massive, to me, underrated player heading into the year in terms of ADP. I thought he was a top 60 type of a guy who was going to play big minutes, and who knows, but if he didn't go down, we wouldn't have got to see Dinwiddie. We wouldn't have seen as much Joe Harris, and Lin and Russell would have played a ton. And then when Russell went down, we would have seen a lot of Lin, and he would have been productive. But he will be 30 by the time the season starts, coming off a serious knee injury, and he's had knee injuries in the past. This is last year. He's already opted into his contract. I don't know what to make of where Lin goes next year. Is he a 25-minute bit player as a guard, you know, backup, you know, playing both positions? I don't really know where he sits. I don't think his opportunity is anywhere near as big as what it was at the start of last season. I'm not sure where to go here with Jeremy Lin.
If Lin's healthy, I don't think that his ceiling is as high as it was going into last season, but I still think that he's going to be put into a role that it's hard for me to imagine them at least not using him in the Joe Harris role next season, the 25 minutes off the bench, if that's what they think he can do, and if he's healthy and they've got Russell ahead of him, maybe they've got Caris LeVert ahead of him in the rotation, just because those guys have taken the next step in their development. But Jeremy Lin is, he's not just coming back from this horrific injury that people are still kind of questioning in regards to whether or not he's going to be able to come back healthy and stay healthy. but some of the minor reports I've seen over the last few months have been positive. But Jimmy Lynn's 30 years old, so and smaller guys, age can catch up to you after you get over that 30-year-old hump. So it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. But the main thing is we got to wait and see whether or not he's actually going to even be healthy enough to play next year.
I'll say this with Lynn. I think that he, at this early stage, profiles as a Tyreek Evans type, take with the last pick in your draft type of a guy, depending on where he... Like, he's consistently, for some reason, despite the insane hype of the insane fans that he has, for some reason, he is always underrated from a fantasy point of view, and you can normally get him 30, 40 spots later than what we project him to become. So I get the feeling that he'll be available in the 130s and 140s. And to me, he profiles as a great option in that spot because if he plays 30 minutes a game, which is a huge if, or even if he plays 27, then the top 70 is clearly within reach for him. The year before, in 16-17, when he did battle those hamstring injuries, he played 24 and a half minutes and he was the 62nd ranked player in 24 and a half minutes. And if you get that out of him at pick 140, you are absolutely laughing. But yeah, there's the case that maybe he only plays 20 minutes. Maybe he gets traded. Maybe the knee isn't right. Maybe age has caught up with him. But that's why he's profiling as this excellent late pick, just to see exactly what happens there, because there's massive opportunity there still for Jeremy Lin. Damari Carroll came across after some disappointing years in Toronto. He was the 111th ranked player. He's not going back to the exact same value he had in Atlanta, but 13.5 points, 2 triples, 6.5 rebounds, 2 assists, 0.8 steals, 41, 76, and 37. At least he got some of his 3-point shooting ability back. He was solid the majority of the season, probably better when he played at the 4 rather than at the 3 when Rondae Hollis-Jefferson was out with a groin issue during the season, but a decently durable year for him. Played the most minutes he had since that first year in Toronto when the knee injuries really bothered him. And his best fantasy finish since that last season in Atlanta when he was the 75th ranked player. If we look at how his that season in Atlanta differs to this year, well, it's the steals. 1.3 versus 0.8, 49% from the field and 41% from the field. They're the two differences that dropped him those 40 or so spots. I don't see the field goal percentage ever really jumping back up for Damari Carroll. But he showed, even at his advanced age, that he can still be useful. And again, this team doesn't have many avenues to improve in all these different areas. So I can see I can see Damari playing a similar-ish sort of role next year, maybe a minute or so less as Rondé stays healthier. And you're making him a really strong back-end guy, but with limited upside.
Yeah, I mean, I think Carroll, he did great. He stayed healthy for most of the year. You know, relatively great in regard to just the fact that he was available to play. And then because of the other injuries on this Nets team, I think that his minutes were allowed to creep up to that 30-minute level this season. I would expect Carroll's minutes to come down a little bit more next year if Rondé is healthier. Because you do have Allen Crabbe there. If Jeremy Lin is healthy, there's so many people available That's to play true. On that wing for this team who have a legitimate path to being a key part of this team in the future, whereas Carroll has that 1 year left and he's 32 years old and you just don't know how big of a role he's going to have eventually. You would like to see Carroll slide into that backup power forward behind Rondae Hollis-Jefferson and occupy that so that we can see those lineups with Lin and Russell and LeVert and Crabbe more often. And I didn't even mention Spencer Dinwiddie into that rotation too. So there's definitely a possibility, I'd say a strong possibility, that Carroll doesn't live up to what he did last season, but he'll probably still poke into somewhere to 24 to 26 minute role, whether that's off the bench or as the starting small forward.
Yeah, I think that's realistic. This team is going to be really tough in trying to figure out their wing and guard rotations next season. I've got no doubt about that. And one of the guys you just mentioned there is the blue swimmer, Allen Crabbe, who's just turned 26. He played 29 minutes per game, 13-4 with 1.6 assists, 2.7 threes, half a steal, half a block, 41, 85, and 38%. He shot the ball horribly to begin the year, absolutely horrendously. But over the last 19 games, he was a top 70 player, averaging 15 points over three threes on 45 and 88%. The big boost there, of course, coming from the fact that he was hitting over three threes per game during that time frame. But he is a guy that I considerably always feel that he is overrated. I don't really love him as a defender. He does nothing. He doesn't pass. He doesn't get steals. He doesn't block shots. Although that was another reason for the bump in value over the last 3 months of the year was the fact that he did block 0.8 shots as opposed to the 0.5 for the year and the 0.3 he'd been averaging in Portland. He's not a high volume scorer, usage under 20%, which is below average. He provides threes and what else? That's it. He hits free throws but doesn't take them. So I don't love Alan Crabb as a player. I think that there are guys that I'd prefer to play over him, like Caris LeVert, like Lin and Russell combinations, like Moore, Dinwiddie. He can space the floor, but in terms of fantasy, his upside to me is fairly limited.
Yeah, I mean, you're mostly, if you're looking at Alan Crabb in fantasy, you're mostly looking at him as a good three-point guy to grab. If he's available late in the draft and you've been punting or you didn't get enough three-pointers early, he is a bulk guy to grab to help you out in that respect. But you don't look at Alan Crabb and think, oh, he's going to expand his game next year. You're going to see him doing more ball handling. You're going to see a greater defensive application. I don't really see that happening. I wouldn't buy into the idea that he could stretch out that 0.8 blocks for an entire season in. I wouldn't expect that at all.
People will look at the last four games of the year and go, shit, like that's really exciting. 25-7 with five triples. 22-4 with five triples. 41-5-4 with eight triples, a steal and a block, and 16-7 with five threes. So that's 23 threes across his last four games, scoring over 20 points in three of those four games, rebounding the ball, getting assists, and that's great. Like 4-4-3 to close the year in assists. But then the three games prior to that, he had a combined zero assists. So it feels really fluky. He can have these hot nights where he does hit these threes, and it was marked by an extraordinary increase in usage. But of course, Dinwiddie sat out some of those games. Russell didn't play in some of those games. It's very hard to get a full view of that. And with those other guys playing, he's just not going to take that many shots, and he's not going to get that hot, and he's not going to handle the ball. But it did at least show, oh, maybe if he's forced into that, he can do it. I just don't think he's ever going to be forced into that on this team unless injuries ravage them again, which again is a possibility. The guy I like on the wing here, Kyle, though, is Caris LeVert, who we saw really blossom in a backup point guard role at times this year. Played on the wing, 26 minutes per game for Caris. He was the 128th ranked player, 12, 3.7, and 4.2, 1.2 threes, 1.2 steals, 44, 71, and 35. Another guy who did struggle early on with his shot quite a bit, really couldn't hit anything, and there was a lot of criticism coming his way. But once he transitioned into that backup point guard role, everything started to come around. He was dishing assists, he gets steals, he rebounds, he was scoring, and he was an excellent must-own player in the middle of the season. But like so many of these guys, where does he fit? Like, what role does he have next year? Does he play more than the 26 minutes per game he played this season? Does in his third season, I can see him pushing to 29 or 30, but I can't see him doing that as the most likely outcome, or I can't see him going higher than that. But out of these guys, out of the Carrolls, the Crabs, the Joe Harris, if he comes back, the Leverts, you know, Caris by far has the highest ceiling because he can score. He can hit threes. He can rebound. He can get assists. He can get steals. And you can do all those things. You have top 50 upside, but getting to that is the real challenge by just getting enough playing time.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to find many holes in Caris LeVert's game when you watch him play out there. He's a scrappy guy. He can do a little bit of everything. You like that he can. When I watch him play, I almost feel like he would fit so perfectly on a team like the Celtics. He just kind of seems to have that mentality that they get out of players. You wish that D'Angelo Russell had the on-court mentality that Caris LeVert had, because Russell has probably the greater talent in regards to vision and shooting ability. But that's not to denigrate LeVert at all. His talent is really nice. You would love to see him step into a 32-minute role and be a starter on a team, because that's going to be his play sometimes. When I look at Caris LeVert, I see a slightly or a little bit shorter version of Chris Middleton in a lot of regard.
Yeah, I can see that. A guy that contributes right across the board. Interestingly, Basketball Reference lists that he played 0% of his minutes at point guard last season, which is clearly comically wrong. We had him, and we go through and do position estimates on Basketball One, so we had him at 30% of his minutes played at point guard last year, and I feel like that's more accurate. Of course I do, because I set those lineups. But I can't believe that they had him at 0% as point guard when he was clearly the backup point guard on this team when Russell was out to begin this season. It was him and Dinwiddie playing those minutes. But I really like Caris LeVert. I think out of that group of guys, the Harris Crabb Carroll group, he's the only one who really does have that top 50, top 60 type upside. But getting there with such a backlog of players in that position might be a tough ask. One guy, Kyle, though, who I think we should all be considering as having top 50 upside as early as next season. I don't think he'll be a top 50 guy next season, but if he ended the year at close to that, I would not be stunned, and he should be a top 100 player, and that is Jarrett Allen, the rookie, 60th ranked player this year in 20 minutes, 8-5. He 1.2 blocks, half a steal, 59-78. And it's those two numbers there at the end, 59 from the field, 78 from the line, that should get us really excited, especially from a rotisserie point of view. If he pushes to 27 minutes per night, over his last 21 games, he was the 92nd ranked player in only 24 minutes. You're talking about 2 blocks, 7 rebounds, 12 points upside with that elite efficiency. And that is a real fantastic base for a fantasy player.
Yeah, no, Allen should be on everybody's list for sleeper candidate or breakthrough candidate next year. Somebody who has the situational or opportunity to potentially break out. With that said, you might end up seeing Allen kind of slide into a 24 to 26 minute role where he ends up playing only 20 minute nights a minute on certain nights, because Kenny Atkinson is comfortable throwing out guys like Quincy Acey as a backup center and Dante Cunningham as a backup center. And there's just, you know, or even Rondae Hollis-Jefferson or Damari Carroll in a pinch, I think, may have spent a couple minutes there. With all that said, Jared Allen, huge upside. You love the field goal percentage, what the free throw percentage portends. I would have liked to have seen a lot more three-point attempts out of him this year. Unfortunately, almost all of his offense seemed to come from rolling to the rack on dish-offs, and you didn't necessarily see him generate a lot of his own offense, but he is... did a tremendous job at rolling to the hoop, keeping himself open, and then scoring efficiently. I just would have liked to have seen that his ability to shoot the ball featured a little bit more this season, and we didn't really get to see that.
He only played 4 games during the season of over 30 minutes per game, but in those 4 games, he averaged 12-11 with 2 assists with over 3 blocks as well at 54% shooting. Hit a 3 in those 4 games as well. One of the only of the five threes he hit for the season. The free throws were fine. And that's where we're looking at in terms of upside with this guy. Now, 30 minutes is probably high, but you talked about those names. The good thing here about it is that Sean Marks can sort of influence the playing time a little bit here, because Jahlil Okafor, Dante Cunningham, Quincy Acey are all unrestricted free agents. If none of those guys are brought back, then the options to play at center are considerably limited for Kenny Atkinson. Not saying that Marks is going to necessarily do that. I don't think that that's, you know, very similar to what Denver did in terms of taking Jameer Nelson out of Mike Malone's hands. So he had to play Jamal Murray. But that is a possibility. With those 3 guys, Cunningham and Acey in particular, who are taking minutes away from Allen, they're both unrestricted. They might not be back with this team. They're not really good enough to be in demand anywhere, so maybe they are, but they're also not good enough to be taking minutes away from a guy like Jarrett Allen. And for as much shit as we give Kenny Atkinson for not giving guys minutes, when they start playing well, the minutes go up. We saw, you know, Rondae push from 22 to 20, almost 29 this year, Caris LeVert up to 26. So if Allen goes from 20 to 26, then it's a clear top 100 player to me. And I think we'll have less of a concern about this Cunningham, AC, Okafor trio taking minutes away than we did last season, because I don't think that all 3 of those guys will be back. They might bring someone else in. Maybe they resurrect Tim Mozgov. But overall, Allen's upside is high. And as you mentioned, if he can start shooting those threes a little bit more, because he's not bad at it, that opens up an extra part for him. So we're really excited about what he can do as we move forward. Only a couple other players I think we need to touch on here. Joe Harris, who averaged almost 2 threes a game, 11 points in 25 minutes. But similarly to Alan Crabb, he doesn't do a huge amount outside of that, although I think he's a better ball handler than Crabb. He's a more efficient shooter, 49 and 42% from the field and from three respectively. And he was, I thought he was quite a important player for this team and a guy who I think is going to attract way bigger deals in free agency than the casual fan might expect.
Yeah, no, if you've watched Joe Harris play basketball, he's competent. He doesn't make mistakes too often. No, and he picks his spots, and he's going to be a good rotation player for some team next year. And it'll be interesting to see if the Nets, given their depth on the wings, whether or not they actually move to bring Joe back.
I'll ask you this question. Would you rather have contract independent? Would you rather have Harris or Crabb on your team?
Probably Joe Harris. It's
yeah, same.
I think you can count on Joe Harris to just execute defensively a little bit better and
consistency.
Whereas, Crabb. You know, I have a conflict with him or a catch 22 in that I love the guys who are willing to take those insanely deep shots to help stretch the defense and also just to put that threat into the other team. The idea that you're going to have somebody who's pulling up from anywhere like a Steph Curry in regards to the depth of their shots or how far away they are from the hoop. But it also, you got to choose the right time. You can't be out there doing it like Nick Young, and when you should be making the extra pass, you're just chucking from an absurd spot and ruining the ball movement on the team. So, without thinking about contract, Josh, sorry for the long answer, but Joe Harris over Alan Crabb.
I would take Joe Harris as well, and I only have one more thing left to say about this team, but a top 10 center in the NBA, according to someone I got into an argument on Twitter with, Jahlil Okafor, finished this team as the worst player on the team in terms of on-off as a negative 18.4. He is terrible. He probably should not be in the NBA next season, and you should 100% not ever be sucked into drafting him into any sort of fantasy league, and that is all I will say about Jahlil Okafor as he continues to show a lack of IQ on the court and a lack of commitment off it.
So is it his defensive deficiencies or is it also his offensive game? Because in defense of the Jahlil Okafor defenders out there or Jahlil Okafor lovers, when you just watch his, and this is the problem with watching anybody's highlights, you got to see the bad stuff too so you understand the full context. But if you only watch Jahlil Okafor's highlights from the Nets this season, he does do some impressive things.
True.
And when he scores the ball, you're like, whoa, how do you do that? Or, you know, he's so crafty around the rim that it's the reason why you can appreciate, you know, he obviously struggles to fit in this era of the NBA that stresses shooting so much when so much of his offense comes right next to the bucket. But it's impressive the way Jahlil Okafor puts the ball on the floor and dribbles between his legs, but it's also extremely annoying the fact that you've got this guy out there who's 7 foot tall, essentially, and every single time he gets the ball, he puts the ball on the floor. And you're just like, nah, dude, why are you doing that? And then he occupies so much time in the paint when he's doing all that. So, yeah, I can definitely see how it stunts things in the modern NBA, but if you're just watching Jahlil Okafor play pickup, he is boss. He's pretty boss.
I will draft him in my pickup fantasy league. Absolutely no doubt about that, Kyle. Now, where can everybody find you on Twitter?
You can find me on Twitter at RotoKyleNBA, and that would be awesome if Jahlil Okafor just was like, you know what, I'm done with this NBA game. I'm going to go play in the Big Three.
Oh, yeah. All right, let's start up a petition for that. Jahlil Okafor to the Big Three. Go follow Kyle on Twitter. Go follow the Big Three on Twitter. And go follow me on Twitter at RedRock_Beeble. Leave a 5-star rating for this podcast and a review. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, and on YouTube. Kyle, thanks for coming back on and discussing the Brooklyn Nets, the team that continues to be a source of consternation for us when we do our projections.
No problem, pal.
All right, guys, we are done here. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. See ya. Spencer Dinwiddie.